You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. It's a warm welcome back to our good friend Malcolm Robinson as he prepares for the upcoming release of his fourth volume in his ongoing Paranormal Casebooks of Great Britain series. Malcolm takes us through some of the more unusual cases featured in this latest volume, from encounters with ghosts both on land and underwater, a series of strange cases involving premonitions and the ramifications of such things. We discuss cellular memory, consider the possibility that Malcolm may have foiled a bank robbery somehow, and a collection of other weird and wonderful stories. A big thank you to Malcolm, as always, for his company and his conversation. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. A big thank you to my two latest patrons, Bri and Daff. Thank you both for joining the gang, and to each and every one of my patrons, thank you very much, as always. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms, whatever they decide to call themselves this week. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And don't forget, you can get your Mysteries and Monsters merchandise by visiting mysteriesandmonsters.com. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Now, for the last time with the current theme music, let's join Malcolm Robinson as he opens the pages of his latest paranormal casebook of Great Britain. Throughout his career, Malcolm Robinson has investigated phenomena from all aspects of the strange and weird. In his latest book, the fourth volume of his Paranormal Case Files of Great Britain, Malcolm continues to share some of the oddest, the unusual, and the most creepy of cases that he's come across. Malcolm, welcome back.
Hello, it's great to be back on your show, Paul. Wonderful.
It is. It's always a pleasure, especially when I didn't think we'd be doing this year. So I'm delighted to speak to you, Malcolm. Welcome.
Obviously I'm a busy man, but at the end of the day, Philip Mantle, who's the publisher of this book, he's asked me to do a number of podcasts, etc., to promote it. And I don't want to let him down. You know, I don't want to upset the man. So, Phil, if you're listening, it's all go.
No, don't worry about it. Your tenner's in the post, Malcolm. So, obviously, most people would probably know you over the last few years, Malcolm, as someone that's released a series of books focusing specifically on a big case rather than some of these collections, but you've been releasing these for several years anyway. So this one, is it the first collection of this type that you've had out for about 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, it probably will be about that, Paul. It's Paranormal Case Files of Great Britain, Volume 4. And, I mean, because I'm so heavily involved in the subject, where we're doing investigations or we're doing lectures, people have got a story to tell. You know, they want to come up to people like myself and unload all these wonderful stories because sometimes you don't really know who to turn to. So I collect all these stories, make sure, obviously, they're truthful, of course. And they've been sitting for a long while. And I've said before on your show, these case files, etc., they're for the public. They're not for a filing cabinet. They've got to get out there so people can read these wonderful stories on ghosts, poltergeists, etc. Because you could be somebody somewhere sitting in a wee house in Barnsley and saying, I can relate to that. That's happened to me. And it's like a big jigsaw. But all we're trying to do with these case file books is just put these stories out to Joe Public and let them understand that, hey, these things are real, you know. But by the same token, we have to ensure that everything that comes our way is pretty, you know, solid, so to speak.
Mm. I mean, that's probably one of the important things. And I know you're not the only researcher and author that pushes these out there, because I think, like you say, Malcolm, these people have obviously got to know you through your television appearances, your appearances on shows like this, on radio. So you've become a real conduit for people to know that they can come forward with a variety of experiences from different aspects of the strange, as I've said, because you've done, you know, you've done cryptozoology explorations, tracking down Nessie. You've done ghostly investigations. Obviously, the very first time I saw you on television was on Sightings doing a ghost hunt many, many years ago.
That Malcolm. Was many, many years ago. Oh, God, that was about 1992 or something. My God.
Yeah, yeah. It's strange when I look back and I think, I know him now. and obviously, ufology. Malcolm,
yes.
So you've got a real reputation of being able to act as a sort of conduit for all aspects of this. So over the years, have you noticed any sort of shift in, do you get more UFO reports these days than you did 20 years ago? Or is it ghosts? Or is it strange encounters that people are having with odd creatures that aren't supposed to be here or not of this earth? Or is it sort of, they're all very constant. These things happen all the time and they haven't really changed. It's just that perhaps the volumes have increased.
That's absolutely correct. You've hit the nail on the head. You know, these things are always there. People always come forward to a degree and tell us what's been happening. And as I've said many times before, for every one person who puts their hand up and comes forward saying, I've seen a UFO, how many people behind them say, well, I did as well, but I'm not going forward. I'm not telling you. So we'll never truly know how much the volume is of UFO reports, of ghostly reports, because I think there's a lot more than we truly know at this point in time, you know. But I'm just so happy and glad that those people are coming forward and unloading and getting them off your chest, because clearly this phenomenon is not going to go away. It's trying to get a handle on it. There's researchers worldwide who's got their own take on what a ghost could be, as have I. The same with UFOs, you know. And that's a good thing as well, because not everybody is singing from the same hymn sheet. It's the old adage, you know, that big box, look out of it, what can you see? We've got to peer even further these days, because the answer is never... It's dangling in front of us, but it's just a wee bit out of reach at the moment. But that's what keeps me involved. And obviously, you've got to keep your feet on the ground, because you're chasing down these ghosts and poltergeists. And what's in this book? You know, I've got a wonderful few good stories to tell you shortly about Alien Bill, a lovely guy from,
yes.
from York, who's taking marvellous strange photographs of orbs and strange lights, and he goes out on a regular basis at night. He goes to a wee field in the outskirts of York with his camera, and he comes back with all these crazy photographs. And, you know, one of them, he was at the Kelpies. It's two horse heads, massive big structures near Falkirk. Hmm. And he went out there one night, and he got this big beam of light shining through between the two heads. And it's not a laser light, it's not a search light, you know, it shouldn't be there. And yet Bill's, it came up in Bill's camera. So yeah, I was happy to put about three or four stories of Alien Bill's and experiences in the book, because they're bloody weird.
Well, I suppose, Malcolm, knowing your body of work and some of the cases you've dealt with, you've investigated firsthand some of the most compelling paranormal cases that we're aware of in the UK, obviously as in regards to the Sorcery poltergeist.
Yeah.
You've had recent interactions with that lady and her daughter who's having all kinds of weird phenomenon that we spoke about last time, and obviously you've covered alien abduction and one of, well, probably Scotland's most well-known UFO case with Deckmont Woods, I would suggest, Malcolm, as a one-off incident, certainly. Is there anything that you've had over the years into these paranormal case files that's even stranger than some of those? Because obviously what I've always loved about a lot of the cases you've worked on is they're not usually the same kind of things that you would read in other cases, where if you look at it on face value, you think, oh, well, like Sorky, oh, well, it's a poltergeist case with a teenage girl. It probably is very similar to Enfield. But when you look at that particular case, it's on a completely different level, especially with what happened at the school.
Absolutely, and that's what makes it so special, is the quality of the witnesses. You know, you're dealing with three local doctors. You're dealing with the Reverend T.W. Lund, a local minister. You're dealing with members of the Church of Scotland. You're dealing with classmates of Virginia who saw the troubles happen in the class, and you're also dealing with an educated teacher who could not believe when her desk rose up and turned round in front of her. So, and then you've got the audio tape recordings that was recorded in by BBC Scope, BBC Scotland Scope programme in 1960. And so it all leads up to just what a great case that is. It's not just a one-off where a wee girl's seen a couple of things and that's it. It followed her, not just happened in the house, it happened at school. They took her to another house, a friend's house, a wee town called Dollar. It still happened there, so it was following her. And then as we spoke the last time, you know, as far as we're led to believe, she's now down in a wee place called Kempston near Bedford, where the Kempston is where the lovely Kinsella twins, of course, live.
Yes.
Great guys. But we're still trying to find out where in Kempston she is, because that would be a great story to get 2023 recollections of those 1960 episodes, you know.
I mean, when I was reading through the book, I mean, it's enormous as well, Malcolm. This is not one of those slim volumes. You know, if you drop this book on your foot, you're going to do some damage to it, sir. You know, you've not sort of just sort of given us a filler here. I mean, it's well over 400 pages. And the section about paranormal encounters that have been sent to you over the years is nearly half the book. It's enormous, and such a variation of cases, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. You know, I try to put all the crazy stories in it, you know, from the ghost poltergeist, the phantom car. We've got obviously haunted Stirling Castle. You've got underwater ghosts. You've got a whole range of different stuff, you know, premonitions. You've got people's life experiences of having to deal with these horrible, horrible experiences. And even one of my good friends who says, you know, if you want, you can use my story when the day I saw a demon. And I'm happy to share that story with your good self, Paul, and your listeners.
Absolutely. Well, I know we're going to dive into some of these cases. So I suspect that's a good enough place as any to start from, Malcolm, because we've got some weird and wonderful things to look at here.
Yeah, I mean, this case, the first case I'd like to bring to your attention and your listeners is my good friend Stephen Bird, and he's SPI's psychic at the moment. A wonderful guy, a very gifted psychic, and he was part of that investigation at Cundorant, Cumbernauld near Glasgow, where the mother and daughter was getting bothered with a nasty spirit called Jeffreys, which we devote a full chapter to in the book. But Stephen Bird, it happened, I think it was October 2020, and it was around about the end of the first COVID lockdown. And Stephen at that time was staying in the town of Stirling in central Scotland. He's now moved to a wee place called Clackmannan, which is near Alloa and near Sauchie. But at the time he was in Stirling, and he was walking down by the River Forth, which was just behind his house. And it may sound strange to some people, but he was conversing with his spirit family, spirit friends, you know, and just having a wee chat, just having a nice wee walk, and it was a lovely day. And then suddenly his guardian angel told him, you better be careful. Something's going to happen very, very soon. You better be careful. And Steve knew straight away that he had to listen to this. You know, it may sound crazy to any sceptical listeners, and that's fine. I understand that. But Stephen says, I've got to take face value what this guardian angel's saying, because I know he's always right. And then he looked about 200-300 yards away. He was looking at a hedge at the Corton Road part of where he stayed in Stirling. And then suddenly he says, Malcolm, he says, it was just like a vortex, a whirlpool of energy. It was like something out the movies, you know, and it was just sort of moving about, smoky. And he went, oh, my God, what the hell is this? Mm. And then his guide told him, he says, be careful, be careful. And suddenly this demonic entity leaped out. I know it sounds bizarre. It leaped out of this vortex, this whirlpool of energy. And he says, Malcolm, don't laugh. I went, what do you mean? He says it was very similar to the Tasmanian Devil cartoon character that you got in the children's TV series. Those of an age will remember that. I certainly do. It was on television here in the UK. And it was similar, not exactly like it, but similar to that. And it started rushing towards him. and it was gnashing its teeth, and it was really going big, big style towards him. So Stephen said to me, he says, Malcolm, at that point, what I did was put what's known as a protective bubble, a bubble of intense, beautiful, warm, white light. It surrounded me. And that, you know, if you speak to any psychics, if they're in any bother, they'll say, that's what they do. They put this protective, or they may have a shield. They can call it a shield, etc. And that's what he did. And soon it was, probably it was about 20 feet away from him, stopped in his tracks, and the guardian angel just kind of pushed it away, and it just went right back into this vortex, and it was gone. And it sounds a crazy story, but this guy is absolutely, Paul, this guy's brand new. I would, you know, trust him with my life.
Mm.
And this is why stories of this nature, and I know some readers will find it difficult to accept that, but why leave it out? Because, you know, it's part and parcel of the demonic side of the paranormal, which doesn't often get spoken about. I got asked the other day that about poltergeists, can they harm you? And yes, they bloody well can. Mm. They can not only throw stuff at you, but they can, for instance, Darren Ritson, a good friend of mine, co-wrote a book with Michael Halliwell, the South Shields poltergeist.
Yes.
And they, when they were interviewing this guy who lived in the house, who had to put up with the problems, he says, oh my God, oh my God. And he went, whoa, whoa, whoa. He says, quickly lift my shirt up. And he lifted his shirt up, and big gouge marks were scratching down his back. Now, these were fresh, Paul. These were not made last week, you know, and scabbed over. These were coming visibly fresh. So it's fair to say that I won't ever shy away from telling listeners of any podcast that are, yes, but these things can harm you, but very, very rare, and mostly only in poltergeist cases, not so much in your residual hauntings, of course, because that's just like a VHS tape of something that happened years ago. But I asked Stephen, you know, our psychic, I said, well, when did you start knowing that when did you have your first experience? He says, oh, it probably was about when I was 6 years of age, Malcolm. I was just sitting in bed. I was lying in bed, and then suddenly I looked down to the foot of the bed, and here's this wee guy. I mean, it was probably the same age as me at the time, but he was dressed in Victorian clothes. And he says he looked solid, but I knew he wasn't there in the sense that he wasn't real. And I says, isn't it strange? Because did you not think that everybody could see these spirit people? He says, I did it first. And then I realised, wait a minute, not everybody can share these things. Not everybody can see these things. And then I realised it's only, well, what he thought was, it was only me at the time. And that's just typical of any psychic medium you speak to. You've probably done a lot in your show. They'll say they had this gift at an early age of seeing spirit. And again, that's why some of the stories featured in this book contain people's observations of not expecting to see a spirit at the time, and it's just bang, it's there. So that's why they've got to be told. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, throughout your work with the SPI, Malcolm, you've utilized a lot of psychics over the years. Is it something that you've noticed that Stephen and some of his predecessors are all following very similar templates, or through your experience of working alongside a variety of people, have different people brought different skills to the table? Have certain people been better at getting a feeling or a conversation going with any disembodied spirits, or is it all much of a muchness, Malcolm? Because I would imagine, unless you really drill down into the world of psychics and differing abilities, on face value, once again, a lot of people will simply presume that they all have the same gift, which, in my personal experience, isn't the case.
I suppose it's like a piano player or a guitar player. Some people are born with a great ability. You'll see some child prodigies on YouTube playing wonderful pieces of piano. They've never studied it. They've never learned it. They've just got this ability.
Mm.
Now, most people, and Steve keeps harping on about this to me, says everybody's born with this ability, but sometimes it's stronger than others. You know, it's like a big battery. And as you grow older, the battery reduces and you've not got that, whilst others have still got that. And we young kids, of course, they see imaginary friends, allegedly they see spirit children themselves, and the mums and dads says, oh no, you're not seeing anything. We should never poo-poo that, because kids at a very early age, as you know, Paul, they can, not them all, but some of them can see spirit. But as far as to your point there, I mean, he's fantastic, Stephen, you know, and we've worked with psychics all these years at SPI. And yes, you can have all the gizmos and the EM meters and this and that. But I've said before, for me personally, I still think you can't beat a good psychic and really drilling down, walking in and getting names and who's behind these disturbances. And Steve's one of these guys. I'm not poo-pooing all his equipment and stuff like that, but yeah, I mean, you can still use that as well, but I still think psychics is the best way forward.
Yeah. I must admit, it was surprising. Well, maybe that says more about me, Malcolm, than anything. But obviously, I've always been interested in premonitions, and obviously you bring one of the most notable cases primarily because of what it created in the aftermath of it, which is the tragedy that happened at Apavan in Wales.
Yeah.
And some of the strange things that were reported by the parents of children that were killed on that tragic day with that horrendous event. And it was interesting because I've heard about a gentleman called John Barker,
mm-hmm.
and him setting up the British Premonitions Bureau after.
Yes, uh-huh.
And the work that he was doing in regards to that. And once again, I think, as we've just been discussing in regards to psychics and their varying abilities, Malcolm, I think often premonitions are once again poo-pooed by a lot of people because they say, oh, well, it's hindsight. People are changing the things. And I think when you look at some of the work that Barker did, especially some of the people that wrote into him saying, I've had this weird premonition, whatever, some of these events and some of the people that he had correspondence with, I must admit, there's something about premonitions that I find quite chilling sometimes, Malcolm.
Yeah, I mean, this is it. I mean, I can understand why members of the public poo-poo a lot of premonitions because, you know, planes crash all the time, sadly. Accidents happen, fires happen, and somewhere in the world, nasty things are ongoing. And so, it's, you know, you can predict that, and it's going to happen anyway. But with the actual, these gifts, these people seeing these disasters before they happen and trying to warn people, I think that takes it to a different level. I mean, the one about the 9/11, the guy's gone to the World Trade Center, I think it was way back in 1993, the first one, and he had a horrible feeling that something was going to happen. And of course, there was a big explosion at the bottom of the World Trade Center. Six people died, I think, about 1,000 people were injured. And then, would you believe it, so many years later, you know, he had the same premonition at 9/11, and when the Twin Towers were attacked by terrorists, and he didn't go to work that day as well. Now, you're just walking to work on a warm day, you're not thinking about anything, then suddenly it's like a big blanket envelops you and say, you're no gone. Don't you go into the World Trade Center today. Something bad's going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, with that gentleman, you say to yourself, well, could you not warn anybody? And even if he did, Paul, you know, phone the Trade Center, I don't think anybody should go to work today because if something's going to happen, nobody's going to listen to him, you know.
Yeah.
And even with the Aberfan that you mentioned there earlier, that horrible disaster that transpired in Wales back in October 1966, wee Evelyn Mae Jones, she was only 10 years old, and she dreamt that in this dream, she said it was like a black thing covering the school, and you know, obviously that black thing was this sludge, was this big tip, the National Core Board coilery tip, just slid down and covered the whole school. And I mean, so sometimes it happens either on the day itself or the night before, but the mechanism behind that, one would say, well, why is not everybody and their granny getting this, you know, and more so if it's going to be a terrible big disaster. I don't think we can explain that. Just suddenly somebody can perceive, they can just look into through the looking glass that these events, you know. And it's a funny one, that. Yeah. But there's so many of these stories. Yeah.
Yeah. I always remember because there was an episode on Arthur C. Clarke when the first series talking about premonitions.
Yeah.
And I remember one particular guy was an American. And he kept having nightmares about plane crashes. And when one of them happened, he ended up being arrested because they were thinking, well, this guy's got some of the information here eerily close. So they suspected that he may have planted a bomb on it, which, as you say, you know, let's be honest, Malcolm, It's stuff that's happened in the past where people have planted devices to try and appear like they're the hero. I know when the bombs went off at the Atlanta Olympics in 96, the guy that actually discovered it was charged at first because they were convinced he must have known about it for the first 5 or 6 weeks. And it was only afterwards that they began to realize that he wasn't there. But it just shows you that often there is a fear of people coming forward and telling people things, because as you say, if you're walking down the street tomorrow, Malcolm, and somebody starts says, hey, what are you doing there, fella? Don't go in that shopping center. I've had a dream, it's going to collapse. You'd be like, yeah, all right, mate, whatever.
I know. Well, I'll give you a good story about that. I think it's actually was featured in one of my other paranormal case files books. Again, it was dealing with another psychic, a lovely lady from Glasgow whose name escapes me at the moment. And she was good as well. But she said there was this bank in Glasgow. It was going to be held up. It was going to be robbed. And she says it definitely, Malcolm, oh, my God, it's definitely going to happen. I'm telling you. But what do you want me to do about it? Could you not phone the bank, Malcolm, and tell them that it's going to be robbed? I went, she said, please, because I'm never wrong. And apparently she never was wrong. So long story short, with trepidation, I picked up the phone and spoke to Strathclyde Police. And it's getting back to your point, you know, they must have thought I was going to rob it or something. You know? So it was one of these conversations. How do you phrase this? What do you say? So I started off saying who I was and investigating the paranormal, and we worked with a psychic and da-da-da. And she's told me this bank in Glasgow is going to be robbed at 2 o'clock or something. I think she even gave a time. And so long story short, the police were there, plain clothes, sorry. that would be funny, wouldn't it?
New policemen arrested in bank heist.
Yeah, they'd arrest themselves. So plain clothes police were there and nothing happened. And so I says, look, nothing happened. I notified the police, you know, and they had a presence there, plain clothes, but nothing happened. So again, what happened? Was it because I put wheels in motion? Was it because, if any robber was there, they would have just seen guys hanging about, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I can't explain that, but she was wrong on that occasion.
Yeah. Though sometimes plainclothes police officers stick out like a sore thumb, Malcolm, for anybody of a criminal mind. They can often get a feeling straight away that things aren't right, because sometimes they just don't look. They still look like a police officer, even in their civvies.
I think it's the red light on top of their hat that's
away. Yeah, well, they were in plain clothes, but they were still wearing their hats. That's what
gave
them away.
Wearing the hat with a red light.
I mean, obviously, Barker, the strange thing about him as well is that one of his premonition experts that contacted him was convinced he was going to die and kept telling him he was going to be going to pass away, and he kind of poo-pooed it. I think they said he was going to die in a gas leak or something. Mm-hmm. And he ended up, he had an aneurysm, I believe, but they said he was going to pass away soon, and he did, because I think he'd only had the bureau open about 3 or 4 years when he sadly passed away.
That's right. I mean, when you look at these premonitions, obviously we can go back in time and look at Mother Shipton, we can look at Nostradamus. And, of course, a lot of people have been poo-pooing Nostradamus, maybe quite rightly. He said he was talking on about this guy called Hister, H-I-S-T-E-R, and what he was going to do in Europe and this and that and other. And, of course, present-day scholars have said, was he meaning Adolf Hitler? Because he did all that. And, again, it's maybe just chance, you know. But, again, we shouldn't poo-poo it. And I always say that in anything paranormal, never, ever poo-poo it, because you got to just look out that box. But not all is what it seems. There is normal explanations for a hell of a lot of stuff in the paranormal, and there always will be. Mm. Some people can be deluded. Some people want paranormal things to happen. You get people going into haunted houses, they hear a wee groan or something, and it's just the wood, the very fabric of the wood in the house just cooling down after a hot day at night. Mm. So there's so many explanations, as you well know.
Yeah, I mean, obviously coincidence is often thrown in, and I think the last sort of premonition thing, which kind of falls into this before we move on to something else, Malcolm, is obviously one of the most famous ones is the Titanic. Now, not only were there several people who cancelled their trips because they had a really bad feeling about things. There's an interview with one of the survivors, who was a girl at the time, whose mother was absolutely convinced the boat was going to sink. She was convinced and did not sleep. She stayed up every night. She got all her clothes on. And so when the ship hit the iceberg, they survived because she was ready to leave, which is remarkable. But of course, the added weird thing about the whole Titanic thing is obviously the book that was written about 10 years earlier about the Titan. That is the biggest ship in the world, sailing across the sea, hits an iceberg, sinks, thousands of people die.
Yeah.
Now that's weird, Malcolm. Even in the realms of coincidence and chance, for it to be so close and so similar in the events that would happen a decade later, that one's always made me scratch my head.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that was quite spooky, the way that the closeness between the Titan and the Titanic, the number of lifeboats was the same, more or less the same size, if I remember correctly, and that sank as well. And then, as you quite rightly said as well, you know, the people on the Titanic, before they boarded it, they had this premonition that, oh no, something bad's going to happen. And it's like some people get this gut feeling. They talk about a gut feeling and women's premonitions or women's intuition or something like that. And then maybe there's something to that as well. You know, some people get this gut feeling that I'm not going to go there today, and something bad happens, or they're driving along the road and they went, I better just slow down just now because I'm not too happy. Something's going to happen. And if they hadn't slowed down, they could have hit an oncoming car round the other side of the bend, you know. So you hear all these stories. You take them maybe with a wee bit of pinch of salt, but there's something in them for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Aberfan has always made me scratch my head, like I said, because it's not just one or two people. There's several that have stories that can chill you if you read about them at the wrong time of day, I think, Malcolm. And I suppose one of the interesting paranormal ghostly sections that you've got is underwater ghosts, and this very strange story from the well-known The Deep, which is in Hull, Malcolm.
That's correct, yeah.
And watery-based ghosts. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of ghosts that are connected with bodies of water. Obviously, as you well know, in Scotland, most bodies of water have a legend or some supernatural creature lurking along the shoreline, ready to drag people in unsuspectingly often or lead them awry. But this is the first one I've heard in a modern-day sort of setting, and especially with this place, because it's really not what you would expect to see in there, is it?
No, it's quite a big place. I mean, I haven't been there myself, though, but I think they've got fish, they've got sharks, there are 2,500 litres of water in there. It's Europe's biggest viewing tunnel at 30 feet long, you know, these underwater viewing tunnels they have.
Mm.
But with that particular case that you're mentioning there, there was a lady called Emma, and Mike Covell, a wonderful guy, wonderful researcher, he dealt with this particular case and he gave me permission to mention it in my book. And the photograph of what appears to show a man's face in the bottom right hand corner of the photograph. Now, it's one of these things, it's very difficult to understand, because if we have ghosts on land, ghosts on sea and aircraft, etc., then probably it stands to reason that that you have ghosts under the water. So when I was doing research for that segment part of the book, you know, there was a number of stories that came along, of which The Deep in the Hull was one of them. But the problem with any given photograph is you have to think along the lines of pareidolia or simulacrum. And for those listeners that's not aware of that, that's just something that, well, your brain is hardwired to make something sensible out of nonsense. And again, I've always referred to, you look up into the sky, you'll see a horse's head, you look into a tree, you can see a face, etc., and you're hardwired from birth to see the shape of your mother's face. Then you get older. So we at SPI, and I dare say many societies throughout the world, get sent lots of photographs, and the vast majority are nothing, you know, they're just simulacrum. And so this face is very, very strong, is very clear. But again, it could still be pareidolia. It's what you want to see. It's like So one of my talks, I give a talk on ghostly photographs, and I always like showing this campfire. And when you look at the campfire, you can clearly see the head of a dog, the ears, the snout, the mouth. Now, if that photograph had been taken a nanosecond later, you wouldn't have got that. It's just the way the flames of the fire, you know. So with that particular one, it's interesting. And the other thing that makes it interesting as well is the fact that the manager claims that it is a haunted building. Why that would be, because it's fairly brand new, I don't know. But yeah, very strange one.
Not half. I mean, as well, as you mentioned earlier, Malcolm, the Kelpies are an incredible artwork that's been installed in Falkirk, and obviously synonymous with strange things around the water. Have you had many reports over the years of people encountering strange figures or having an encounter with something paranormal by a loch or a river in Scotland? Is it something that's still... Because obviously there are certain bodies of water around the world that have a ghost attached to them that may have come to an untimely end, it would seem.
Yeah, it's funny. Bodies of water, they've always got associations with the paranormal and ufology. More so reservoirs. I've noticed there's a few cases in Scotland where UFOs have been seen and sighted around reservoirs. And of course, the A70 abduction was close to Harper Rig Reservoir as well. And so that's bizarre. I mean, the tradition of the water kelpie, the water horse in Scotland, goes way back through the centuries. And it probably is just a folk tale, you know, these horses pulling. Well, initially they were like females. They turned into a horse and they pulled an weary traveller down into the depths of the loch, etc. I mean, I've seen a UFO at Loch Ness. I interviewed Frank Serrell, who was a Nessie hunter. Sadly, Frank, his photographs were all faked. And in my Loch Ness book, I have a chapter on him all about his faked photographs. But that time when I went to interview him about his Nessie sightings, and I brought up the fact that the previous week he had taken a photograph of this UFO swooping down across Loch Ness near Foyers. It's a small area at the shores of Loch Ness, and woof, went away back up into the sky. So I said, Frank, let's talk about this UFO. It was in the Daily Record there just last week. Nope. Sorry? Nope. You're here to talk about the Loch Ness Monster. You're not talking about UFOs. If you start talking about UFOs, I'm ending this interview right now. Do you understand? I went, OK, Frank. Yeah, OK, fair enough. And so I dare say that that was manufactured as well, because you had no background. It was just a cloudy sky, you know. And to some degree, it looked a wee bit like Billy Myers' photograph of Hinwil in Switzerland, who was the one-armed farmer who got all these, what he called, Pleiadian craft. And I don't think... I'm not so sure about that. I think a lot of them are faked. I could be wrong, but that's my taking it. More so when Ground Saucer Watch submitted one of his photographs to their technology back in the day when it was ever growing, and they uncovered a very, very, very thin support. I wouldn't say rope or string. It was not even string. It was like fishing gut, yeah, holding this model, you know, from a tree. But the thing is, some people still want to believe in these Billy Meyer and this and that and the other, because sadly the desire of human beings to believe in something oversteps the mark of credulity and the mark of honesty, and you've really, you know, you can't change your mind. You know, I'll show you a piece of white paper, you'll say it's black. So it's truly the debunkers, not the skeptics. The debunkers refuse to look out that box. Their mind's made up. That's it. You can't tell them anything. And sadly, I've came across these guys and gals over the years. What I can say is not so much in the last 10 years, which is always good.
Yeah, well, I have to say, I'm surprised how Billy Meyer still keeps popping up, Malcolm, all these years later. It's like every 5 years, Billy Meyer pops up and people say, oh, yeah, it's definitely. And so, like you say, I think often... You know, we can always point fingers at debunkers and skeptics and say that they are just so dogmatic in their belief. But I think often there are individuals, especially in ufology, who attach themselves to very well-meaning researchers. There are numerous people, as I'm sure you're aware, Malcolm, who have made outlandish claims and claimed to supply evidence And it's only when you begin to pick it apart that the stories begin to not really resonate anymore. There's something not quite right about them. And Meyer is one of thousands of such characters over the years, it would seem.
I think we should, just like the police with murders, I think we should look at cold cases or cases back in the day. You know, I started watching, I think it's UFO Hunters or something. Bill Burns, is it?
Yes.
And I never watched that show when it first came out, but I watched it now, and they're going back looking at cold cases and stuff, the Socorro case and other stuff as well, and Phoenix Lights, etc. And maybe that's what we should do now, looking back. Maybe even in the Deathman Woods case, I'm quite happy for people to turn over the files, turn over the information, and look carefully and pick, if they can pick holes in it, great. And maybe that's an exercise for people to do as well. Let's go back and look at some cold cases. But that's just my thoughts.
Yeah. No, I think it is. I think it's very interesting. I mean, it's, I think what often can sometimes happen in these cases as well, and there's a prime sort of connection to that, because obviously Alan Godfrey's case in Todmorden in 1980 is very well known. It's easily Yorkshire's most famous UFO case.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan's always kind of tried to distance it from the mysterious murder that occurred about 6 months earlier.
Oh, yes, yes.
Uh-huh. With the gentleman found mysteriously on the coal tip.
Yeah.
And that aspect of it is one of those parts that often people say, oh, well, we've solved this, and yet there's no real evidence for it being solved. And I remember, I've forgotten the chap's name.
The guy in the coal tip was Adamski.
That's it, yeah. That's where. Because I've always found it odd that we had this guy called Adamski who lived near Wakefield. And obviously Adamski is a very famous name in the world of ufology because he's one of the key contactees in the 1950s, wasn't he?
He was.
So that apparently was closed, that part of the case, because an anonymous person rang the local police and said, oh, he's been tortured and killed by relatives of his stepdaughter. And that was it. I mean, there's no evidence that any of that's true, but people say, right, well, we know it's not weird now, he was done like that. But there's no evidence for it. It's just a random person allegedly called the police to tell them what had happened. There's no evidence that was the case.
Yeah, it's a very bizarre case, that one. I mean, I firmly believe that Alan Godfrey saw what he saw without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah.
I think possibly the body of Adamski on this coal tip was just one of these weird, weird coincidences. I don't think it had anything to do with the initial UFO. I mean, there's clearly a period of missing time. We know that Alan was regressed, etc., and some strange stuff came out. But, yeah, it's you know, to his dying day, and, you know, I'm sure Alan will always say that that happened, you know, and it was an incredible case. I mean, funnily enough, I'm reading about David Jacobs' book, Walking Among Us.
Yes.
The Alien Plan to Control Humanity. What a wonderful book that is. However, I must say to yourself and your wonderful listeners, if you can, please go to Amazon and get a book called Out of Time, the Intergenerational Abduction Program Explored by Steve Aspin. What a wonderful book. That's probably one of the best UFO abduction books I've ever read. It's terrific. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, Jacob's work is deeply troubling on some levels, and yet whenever I heard him speak about them in the past, Malcolm, he's very humorous about meeting these, because there's hybrids and hybrids and this kind of agenda that's going on.
Yeah.
And he seems very sort of non-committal about being frightened by it. I know he's mentioned a few occasions where people have kind of tried to sidetrack him in regards to his research because they think he's getting too close, but he's always dealt with that particular, and obviously very similar working alongside Bud Hopkins before his sad passing, that those two were really prominent in kind of pushing this contactee hybrid situation that seemed to be going on, where they had incredible cases. And once again, it would be interesting, with everything that's currently going on in the US Congress, and as we speak, they've been having another hearing today. I've watched a bit of it earlier.
Uh-huh.
Some of the evidence that they were giving was eye-opening, to say the least. Clearly, there is a lot more to this than meets the eye, it would suspect, Malcolm.
Yeah, I mean, I've known for years, you know, that the CIA, the FBI and the NSA over in America were actively involved in UFO research. They are a cover-up to some degree. We've looked at a lot of the documents. The documents has been released under the Freedom of Information Act, passed here in the UK as well. A lot, as I've said, I think, before in your show, some of these documents are heavily black penned out, big paragraphs upon paragraphs. Now, if they're releasing them, get rid of that black ink. Let's see what's below that black ink. Now, it can't always be people's addresses, which they obviously have to, you know, black ink out that. I understand that. But when you look at some of the files, it's all, and again, I'm not saying it's UFOs. It could be classified government experimental aircraft, which a lot of these UFOs flying about our skies are. Not them all by a long chalk. We are dealing with a truly extraterrestrial or interdimensional presence here on planet Earth. But a lot of the stuff in our skies, our own stuff, experimental drones, etc., but not them all. Because I would never be involved in this subject if I didn't honestly believe that they were dealing with something real, bona fide. It's always been with us, but as for the answers, who knows? What I'd like to do is share a couple of quick stories with yourself and your listeners.
Yeah.
Now, this one concerns the Outer Limits Conference, which happened in Hull, the Freedom Centre in Hull last year, put on by the wonderful Chris Evers.
Yes.
And editor of the Outer Limits magazine. So, again, very bizarre. It's in the book. That's why I'm plugging it. And but for those who's not got the book yet, Alien Bill Rourke, who we spoke about at the top of the show, a lovely guy from York, and he's into his UFOs. Anyway, he went into the gents' toilet. Nobody was in. He was drying his hands. Then he felt a chill at the right-hand side of his head on his ear, and he heard this gravelly voice. This gravelly voice said, "You all right, mate?" and he went, "What the blood?" And he turned out nobody was there. So he thought maybe somebody was hiding in the cubicle. So he opened it. Nope, nobody was there. And as he went down the corridor, you know, he mentioned to Chris, who was coming down, he said, "Oh, hi, Chris." Chris told him this Freedom Centre has got a haunted reputation. Now, it gets even stranger because he went back to the auditorium, he sat in his seat, he sat beside his wife, Vic, and also a lovely lady called Kathy Cogliano from Massachusetts. Mm. And so they're all sitting there. And funnily enough, I was on the stage talking about the Socky Porter guys. So there's me, oblivious to what was going on at the back of the hall.
Yeah.
I'm talking away about Socky. And then suddenly... And listeners, you're about to be bamboozled by this, but I kid you not. Suddenly, this arm, just from the fingertips to the elbow, just an arm, a clothed arm with a black, you know, black suit, started. It just appeared. It was moving from the right to the left at knee height, just above Alien Bill, just near Kathy Cogliano and Vic, and it was floating. It never went up and down. It just moved slowly. No body, nothing there, just this arm. And when I asked Bill and Kathy, tell me more about it, they says it was like an old man's hand, but it wasn't, you couldn't see the veins. It didn't have any rings on it, but it was like a dark bluey kind of jacket, and it just kind of faded away at the elbow. And when Vic never saw it, Alien Bill's wife, she never saw it, but what she did see prior to that arm appearing was a ball of light in the auditorium. And you know, that's absolutely crazy, you know. But what people have to realize is when we're talking ghosts, when we're talking spirits, it's not always a full body appearance. You know, you can get bodily parts. I mean, for instance, in a case in Stirling years ago, I turned round and all I saw was from the knee down this white big sock and a big black boot with a silver buckle, the type of clothes and shoes that they wore back in the day, you know. And we have photographs of just ghostly heads, ghostly arms, hands, etc. But it's a wonderful story. But another story that Bill told us was, again, it's such a big story, I'll try and be brief. He was at the Lysander Arms pub in Rockcliffe in York, and he was cycling back in the pouring rain, was chucking it down, and he had a UFO experience that night as well, which is too long-winded to go into here. Get the book, folks. And so he then suddenly found himself in this lane with trees to the left, trees to the right, that rain is still bucking it down. And he went, where the hell am I? And Bill knows York and the surrounding areas of York like the back of his hand. They're a Yorkshire man. Mm. And he didn't realise where he was. He went, what's going on? And he suddenly looked at the bottom of this lane, and there was this hooded lady, this caped lady, this big cape, and it went right down to her feet. You couldn't see the feet. And she was slowly not walking. She was gliding along. You know, the shoulders were not going left, right. You know, the hunch of the shoulders when people walk. Mm. None of that. It was just static, gliding along. Like, oh, my God, this is strange. What's going on here? And then Bill had the common sense to get his bicycle light, and he shone it. Maybe he shouldn't have done that, but he shone it towards this woman. And he says, Malcolm, there were no face. It was just blackness under that hood. So I moved my bike out the road to let her pass. And he went, wait a minute, I better. And he says, when the rain was coming down, she didn't appear wet, you know, and there was no splashing going around her. And it was like the rain was just penetrating right through her. It wasn't hitting off the scape. And so she's walking along, and he says, I better take a photograph, because he's always got his camera to hand. And by the time he got his camera, she just suddenly turned a greyish mist, and boop, she was gone. And it's a wonderful story. Is it evidence? Well, it's certainly evidence to Bill Rourke, for sure. Is it evidence to your listeners? Maybe some might take it on board, maybe some might not. But that's the beauty of these things that happen to us. You know, they come at the unexpected times, and that's what's so bizarre.
Yeah. I think there's a wonderful description in Bill's discussion with you in the book about it, when he says I shone his torch into her hood and it disappeared. It was like it had been swallowed, and he sort of compares it to a black hole. It just seems to absorb all the light. It's a very odd encounter, and to be so descriptive, Malcolm, without it sounding a cliched one, because for someone to describe a feminine, because that's the other thing, I think Bill describes it as being feminine rather than knowing it looked like a woman, but he, obviously, if you couldn't see the face, you can't be for sure, but he just had the feeling it was feminine. It's a very odd description. A big, heavy wool cape on a rainy night. It's not really the kind of garment you would be wearing in a heavy rainstorm.
No, for sure, for sure. And I mean, he's also been attacked. I don't think this story's in the book. It may have been in a different book, by a shadow man. He was he saw this big tall figure emerging from a hedge, just like the story I spoke about earlier with Stephen. But it came out this hedge, this tall black shadow guy, and it rushed towards Bill and knocked his glasses off his head, you know. And there are not many. A lot of people claim to see Shadow Man, but there's Bill interacting with them, physically knocked his glasses off. And yes, these stories sound bizarre. Yes, they're crazy, but it'll be a very sad day if I stop putting them in my books, because somebody might ring me up and says, Malcolm, I'm so, so glad you put that story in, mate, because I'll tell you what, that happened to me 4 years ago or whatever, you know. And I always say to your good self and your listeners, it is a jigsaw puzzle. The paranormal is a big jigsaw puzzle. There's far better guys than me involved in researching this and trying to knit together all these mosaic pieces and see what we're left with. But yeah, I love it so much. I love it.
Absolutely. And I think one of the good things about your work and your books, Malcolm, is that you don't sort of think, oh, I'm not sure about that one, it doesn't really fit in with something. Because I think you cover such a wide range of phenomena, you're quite happy to cover it, because, you know, we've spoken about this before. Bill is someone who is very into ufology and his personal experiences. So for him to then want to share paranormal encounters, because obviously there's another one in there about an encounter with a ghostly dog.
Yeah.
You would not, you know, if normally Bill would be speaking with people immersed in ufology, nobody would probably give him the say, oh, well, I'm not really into ghosts, sorry, have you got any more alien stories for me? Whereas for you, Malcolm, you're like, yeah, brilliant, that's I can deal with that, I can roll with this, that's fine.
Well, you're right. And you know, you mentioned the dog. It's that was Rocky. It's his little dog. and that passed away sadly. You know, it was, I think it was half Chihuahua, half King Charles. It passed away, and it was, you know, it was very sad. But it didn't really pass away, as you'll learn in the book, because it started springing up. He saw it. He was going down the stairs, and there's wee Rocky right at the foot of the stairs, looking at him, the head tilted. And as he went down the stairs, it just kind of disappeared. It followed him to a kitchen. He's seen it in the flower garden, out the back garden. You know, it was either him or Vic was doing the dishes one day, looked out the kitchen window, and there's wee Rocky. He's dead, but he's running about the garden. Now, skeptics will say it's a wish, it's a desire to not let go, and that therefore your brain is programmed to see him in his environment where he was happy. And some people might say that's fair, but then again, a lot of people would say, Malcolm, I've seen, and people have, they've seen their dead dogs or cats. And again, in a previous book, I talk about ghostly animals, with ghostly horses, etc., etc. And, I mean, we mourn the passing of a loved one. Of course we do. But a lot of people mourn the death of their pets more than a human being, because that affinity that they have with them is so strong. And so, yeah, it's good to know that... he's still around. He'll eventually go away. You know, I'm sure he will. But he's just letting Bill and Vic know that he's still around for the moment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, where I'm speaking to you from today, Malcolm, is my mother's house, which is has a couple of residents here that don't pay rent, shall we say. and one of them is one of our old dogs, Ross, who is a big Labrador. He was one of those wonderful Labradors who was essentially the size of a bear, but believed he was still a puppy, Malcolm. So he'd always try and crawl on your knee, you know, even though he weighed 10 stone. You know, it's not the comfortablest dog to snuggle with on your knee. But
yeah.
He always used to wear a silver chain. And whenever he ate, it would always bang against his dish. So my mum's always looked after rescue dogs since he passed away. And none of them have ever worn a silver chain.
Uh-huh.
On occasion, I don't know, maybe once a month. I mean, I've heard it once. There are... people that have visited my mum have heard it. You can clearly hear on occasion, usually late at night, about 10-ish, half 10, 11 o'clock, you'll suddenly hear the noise of a chain banging against a dish.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Like it's having its dinner. You never see anything.
Yeah.
You don't hear paws padding about or panting or anything. It's just now and again, you'll just hear a chain banging against one of the metal dishes. And it's always odd as well, because the dogs that she have will sit and look into the kitchen when the noise starts, but they won't go in. And then as soon as it stops, they go in.
Wow. I mean, there you go. That's a great story. That's just typically the type of stories I receive. And everybody's got a story to tell, you know. And I mean, even my own daughter, she lives in a fairly new house, but prior to getting it, she's only the second tenant. There was an old lady that died in the house. And over the past year or so, they hear footsteps when they're down in the living room. They hear footsteps up the stair, and the usual, when you go up there, there's nobody to be seen. You know, she says, Dad, it doesn't bother me at all. I'm used to it, but I would like to know for sure who it is. So I'm thinking about getting Stephen Bird, the SBI psychic, in just to see if he can pick up anything. It might not be the lady that died in the house. It could be somebody else. But it's when my own family's telling me that, and even my granddaughter, God, I shouldn't be telling you these stories. Even my granddaughter... she's a teenager now, but when she was younger, she looked up the stairs, and my daughter, Stacey, she says, what are you looking at, darling? Looking at lady. Oh, what lady? Lady top stair. Lady Sadie. What was her name? Sadie. And now that's not a common name in Scotland. And I had an Aunt Sadie who died. Now, are we putting two to do together here? Or are we, you know, but clearly she was too young to ever, she didn't know Sadie. She had died years and years before. But we could surmise that maybe that was my Aunt Sadie going round the family, and or not. But it was kind of bizarre.
Mm. Well, it is interesting that, especially when it comes to kids, and I was talking about this on the other show I do, The Ghost Story Guys, Malcolm. We were talking, we'd had a couple of listeners emailing with stories about children playing with invisible people on the stairs.
Yeah.
And we were thinking, why is it stairs seem very common, especially when it comes to children's encounters? Because my niece only visited the house I used to live in once, which I know for a fact was owned by an old couple. The husband passed away in the house. The wife, unfortunately, suffered from serious dementia and passed away in a hospice. But the only time she came round, she was fine for about an hour, and then she just went and stood at the bottom of the stairs, and she was just waving. Like, she's three or four at the time, Malcolm. It's about three, 4 years ago, this? Yeah, it'll be 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And so, didn't think anything of it, and she was transfixed. So I said, oh, what are you doing, my love? Who are you waving at? She says, oh, I'm waving at the old lady at the top of the stairs.
Good.
Now, I'd never said that to her. I'm sure my brother didn't even know anything about the previous tenants.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't have mentioned it. It was the first time she'd been to the house. You know, you're not going to sit around and say in front of a four-year-old, oh, well, you know, be careful because the people who used to live here are both dead now. And she just said, yeah, I'm waving at the old lady.
Well, yeah, again, that's just typically the stories we hear, and it's just great that you're sharing them as well. Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah. So I suppose as well, Malcolm, because of the volume of reports you get, because obviously, like you say in the book, a lot of people hear you on other shows, or they see your books, or they've been at one of your presentations. Is it still as we were saying earlier on, do you think it's become a lot easier for people to share these stories? Because obviously, as you've been immersed in this for, you know, over 40 years now, Malcolm, which it probably seems like 5 in the scheme of things.
Yeah, it does.
Obviously, these days, it's a lot easier, I would imagine. Do you get far more reports than you could ever do before? And because in the old days it was letters and telephone calls, whereas now somebody can just go Malcolm Robinson's email, ping.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. That's the beauty of today's technology, that you're getting stories shared all the time. And I mean, you're right, back in the day, it was I had no email, you know, the mobile phones weren't there as well. I think Fred Flintstone was my next door neighbour, but you know, that's how old I am. And it's when you were dealing with UFO signs, you had to send letters to the airports, yes, and the police and that. And 9 times out of 10, you never got a reply. And now if you put in a Freedom of Information request, then they've got to reply, really, you know. And so, yes, to answer your point, it's a lot easier these days. And you can communicate, as we all know, the drop of your hat, you know, a finger on a key switch, and you're talking to somebody in Australia. That's why podcasts and all Skypes and Zooms and all that bring this, you know. There's another thing, because when I worked with the television back in the middle to late 90s and early 2000s, you had camera crews coming to your house. Now they just do it over Zoom, you know, so they're cutting down the cost, the carbon footprint. They can do it quite easily over Zoom or Skype, which is fine for both parties, I guess, you know. And so, yeah, technology's brought it to the 21st century, of course.
I know there's a section in the book which is quite interesting, I think, especially what I've noticed over the last sort of 5 to 10 years, Malcolm, especially in the British tabloid press.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you've got a chapter focusing on the media and the paranormal.
Yeah.
Do you, as someone that's contacted regularly to appear on in the media, I know, as you were saying earlier on, you've been doing a few newspaper interviews recently. Are you surprised that there seems to be more strange stories of a paranormal nature appearing in those types of British press over the last few years? Because I remember growing up, and I'm sure you do as well, Malcolm, there'd be the odd really big case that would cross, you know, Salkey was in the press because a local journalist helped break the story, and you'd got certain cases appearing on the BBC at that period. Enfield was obviously very famously covered by the Daily Mirror. But nowadays, it seems that whether it's UFOs, people claiming to have married a ghost pirate, strange things washing up on beaches, people with weird afflictions, there doesn't seem to be any lack of appetite for these stories. If anything, for me, it seems to be the most prevalent it's ever been in the British press.
Yeah, especially the Daily Star on the front page all the time, you know. Yeah, it can be silly season for the newspapers and stuff, and if they get any crazy stories, then they're obviously going to use them. I mean, today I was speaking to the Sunday Mirror, somebody, and this lady who was interviewing me, She was, you could clearly see by the questions that she didn't really know ufology very much, and she was just asking this line of questions. It was about Bonnybridge, incidentally, and which is fine, you know. And I was just happy to try and educate her to what was going on in the skies above Bonnybridge. But that's happened time and time again. You get these young 16-year-old people working for newspapers who have to phone this Mr. Robinson about, and they don't know nothing themselves, you know. They're asking daft questions now. But it's got to be done, you know. And as long as they, I think I've only put the phone down on one journalist years ago. He was really taking the mic. And I'd say, okay, good night, bye. Down it went, you know.
I think the last bit I want to touch on before I let you go, Malcolm, to the real world, is there's a in this particular section about the media, you've got this wonderful chapter focusing on strange things. One of them is one of my favourites, which is cellular memory, which is people who have life-saving transplants who suddenly start to develop strange habits after they've recovered. I mean, one of them that made me chuckle was this chap called Simon Cooper, who was a drummer, who clearly wasn't from Yorkshire, Malcolm, because apparently he never swore till he was 29, and then he had a transplant and he started swearing like a trooper.
Yeah, it's a controversial subject, that, and I've actually, one of my lectures is about cellular memory as well. And for those who are maybe getting accustomed to it on your show for the first time, it, as you said, you know, it can be a lung or a heart transplant. And, you know, a couple of quick for instances, somebody gets a lung and they've hated motorcycles. They hate the smell of any motorcycle going by them. And then suddenly when they get this heart in that, all they want to do is ride motorcycles, wear leathers, you know, and there's so many cases like that. Or maybe someone hated alcohol and they've got, obviously, the lung of somebody who had that, not a liver, of course, but a lung. Yeah. And then suddenly, wouldn't be the liver. Yeah. And then suddenly they just want to drink alcohol all the time. So what we're surmising out of this, like genetic memory must be impregnated within the very fabric of these hearts and lungs, etc. But why can that then suddenly make people want to do these things? And it's not just a couple of isolated cases. You know, the cases I mentioned in my book is just the tip of the iceberg. Now, I would like to say to your listeners, don't worry, folks, if you're going through a heart transplant, you won't suddenly, you know, want to kill people in that. But it's not like that all the time. It's just a few isolated cases where people have this. And then when they do the research, because you're not meant to tell who the donor is. You know, this person's donated their organs, and generally the health practice is you don't tell the recipient who got that who it was. But sometimes that leaks and they find out, and that's when they find, what? He was a motorcyclist? What? A drunk? So I just hope that those listening to your show, when they see that part of the book, can understand that this is a phenomenon as well. Might not be paranormal, admittedly, but it's still a phenomenon.
Yeah, it is very strange, because obviously these people that have these transplants seem to pick up these weird changes in their tastes or their vocabulary or their behaviour. They don't know anything about the person that's donated their organs to help save their lives, Malcolm. You don't get a little book saying, "Oh, this is the person whose organs you now have."
Yeah, correct.
So the other chap, Henry, who didn't like beer and now loves it. I find little things like that, they make me smile. I think they're lovely stories because they're just really weird. But they don't, you know, like you say, they're not sort of sending people into psychosis. These are weird little quirks that people just seem to overnight develop new tests.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating subject. It can be worrying as well because, say, for instance, they donated the heart or the lung of a murderer. And this is just off the top of my head. You know, say that happened. Mm. Would the person who got that lung or the heart of the murderer, would they go on to have tendencies to kill people? I hope not. But it's just a tricky one, that.
Yeah. Well, the book is chock full of wonderful cases that cover anybody's interests, I think, Malcolm. And for people like me, it covers everything, really. So I'm you know, laughing the way to the bank reading this book. There's something for all my interests. Where can everybody get hold of a copy, follow your books? And what else have you got coming up, my friend?
Yeah, they can get my books obviously from Amazon, if you just type in Paranormal Case Files of Great Britain Volume 4, now admittedly it's not officially released until August the 1st, but you may be able to get some copies just now, but the official release date will be August the 1st. What's coming up for me is quite a number of projects, one of which I'm speaking about the Bob Taylor case, the Deckman Woods case again on August the 6th at the Mercure Hotel in Livingston, and that's 7:30 through to about 10 o'clock. The reason I'm talking about it again is when I gave it on the anniversary, the 40th anniversary of the case a few years ago, the place was absolutely packed. So many people tried to get in. I said, I'm sorry, you can't get in. People are lying on the floor and standing at the side of the walls. And so I promised, like General MacArthur, I'll be back. I'll give it again, you know. So that's why I've called it the Return Lecture, because for those people who couldn't get in the last time, so Mercure Hotel, Livingston in West Lothian, and that's in a few weeks' time, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, as always, Malcolm, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for yet another wonderful book. I know you've got some exciting ventures coming down the line, and I'm probably definitely not going to speak to you for quite a while now, but as always, I will look forward to catching up with you, because it is like speaking to an old friend these days. So thank you, as always, for your time, your trouble, and continuing to release such wonderful books.
It's been a pleasure, Paul, and thanks ever so much for having me back on your show. You're doing a wonderful job yourself, keeping that message going, letting people know. Thank you very much, sir.